everyone, and welcome to Jolly's Spring 2022 podcast series. This is Jennifer Irvin. I'm the managing editor at the Journal of Language and Literacy Education. We are a peer-reviewed, open-access journal housed in the Department of Language and Literacy Education at the University of Georgia. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Leah Panther, who's an assistant professor at Mercer University, and Latoya Tolfrey, a doctoral candidate at Mercer University. And their manuscript is titled Youth Testimony to Contend with Trauma. Thank you guys so much for joining me today. I really look forward to hearing more about your work.
Yeah, so glad to be here. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So I just want to start with a broad question about how researchers or educators might approach trauma-informed pedagogies. At the end of your article, you refer to Eve Tuck's call for an end to damage-centered narratives in research. Can you speak on how teachers or researchers who are interested in trauma-informed or healing pedagogies can respond to Eve Tuck's call?
Right. So Latoya and I actually came to the work of trauma-informed pedagogies, I think like a lot of educators did several years ago, and it was born out of absolute necessity. I am a teacher educator and also part of a long-term school-university partnership with Creek High School. And then Latoya, at the time, was an instructional coach. Now she's both an instructional coach and a classroom educator at the elementary level. So as we were both working with students and teachers during the wonderful spring of 2020, and everyone was going into rather panic mode and survival mode with that transition to emergency online teaching, we were texting and emailing and Googling, like, how do we support socially isolated students? How do we help our teachers and keep them free from burnout? Also, a very real conversation that we had to have around, how do you teach the day after the news breaks about George Floyd? Or for our more geographically like local context, Ahmaud Arbery and Rashard Brooks. So how do we have these conversations? And as we are trying to figure out the answer to these questions, we kept coming across the word trauma. So I guess the first piece of advice to avoid those damage-centered narratives is to avoid doing what Latoya and I first did, which was to just Google trauma-informed pedagogies or to find maybe some of the more popular resources out there about it. Because for the first 3 months, as we're reading about trauma-informed pedagogies, there's a lot about the work that really didn't sit right with us for various reasons. So I would encourage others to learn from maybe our missteps and instead start right away with the work of Adam Alvarez. He has this beautiful systematic literature review of trauma-informed pedagogies that really critiques a lot of the over-deterministic and fatalistic ways that scholars are thinking about and talking about trauma-informed pedagogies, in particular, the ways that it neglects these larger macro systems that create and sustain trauma for learners, and how race is often erased completely from the discussion of what is creating trauma or maintaining oppression for youth. And so then as we started to think about it in those terms, we were able to find some other scholars I would recommend that others look into, including April Baker Bell, Antero Garcia, Roberta Gardner does some beautiful work at the elementary level, Mark Lamont Hill, Elizabeth Dutrow, and all of these scholars you'll see throughout our piece and our manuscript, because they're thinking about trauma in terms of not just how do you rip off the Band-Aid and look at it and poke it and name it and define it, but then how do you actually heal it? And that's this approach that starts with, of course, attacking the systems and the macro structures that create trauma, but then coming alongside to do the healing. And that involves having youth agency as they are able to heal wounds. They're not just these passive recipients of trauma and then they stay in that position their entire lives. So I guess those would be the kind of two overarching pieces of advice to avoid some of the traps we fell into thinking about trauma in terms of this damage-centered narrative of youth and of communities, by starting by thinking about what are those larger macro systems that actually create trauma? And then how do you come alongside communities to think about what resources they have within them to think about and conceptualize their own healing?
Thank you so much for that. That's really helpful. And I think even just in the reading the article, I learned a lot just in the framing and the way that you're using the terms healing pedagogy, like those are some new languages for me. And so I appreciated that, some new terms. You mentioned that in your article, Mr. Woods, the teacher who's involved in your study, asked to see the video of the student's testimony because he did feel a little bit disquieted by an interaction that he had with the student in that video. Did he have any reflection on that review that you might be able to share? Or, like, maybe more broadly, do you have any advice for teachers on how they might respond if student testimonials do end up reproducing harmful stereotypes, which is kind of what played out in your article? You know, how can we prepare for this?
Mm-hmm. Right. So I'll take the first half of that, Latoya, if I can talk you into taking the second half. So to start, I will say that within the context of the study, I was able to be there virtually. It was, of course, during the summer of 2020. So I was able to virtually be with Mr. Woods and come alongside of him and offer him some support. And really the first step as he was reacting to Bobby's testimony of racialized trauma and his sharing of some racialized stereotypes that he had about communities, the first step was really self-education. So Mr. Woods and I are both white educators. And so it's not up to communities of color or communities who have been historically marginalized. It's not their responsibility to educate us. So it started with us doing the reading and the work to understand what do we need to know about Vietnamese communities, particularly to this geographic context, in order to understand what it was that Bobby was potentially experiencing. And then also to think about what are the roots of these racialized stereotypes that Bobby has about the Black community that his mother was interacting with. And so from there, we were able to first self-educate, but then also secondly, maybe we weren't able, or maybe Mr. Woods wasn't comfortable responding in the moment. He didn't have the language or the knowledge at that point, but then you must address these racialized stereotypes and assumptions. So preparing him for that next session. So what's a way that we can shift the language from these closed questions to open-ended questions? So you're able to maybe clarify some of these understandings and misconceptions that the learner has. And then also, what are ways that we can then provide resources to educate Bobby to maybe clarify or challenge some of these sustained misconceptions that he has about members of his own local community. So for Mr. Woods, it looked like first self-education, and then second, thinking about ways to, again, center Bobby's testimony, not critique him, but instead point to what are those larger systems that are informing the ways that he's thinking about communities of color. But as for how that might generalize to other contexts, Latoya, did you want to try to speak to that?
Sure. So as I begin adding on to what Dr. Panther shared, I do just want to make it clear that we're offering recommendations for preparing teachers. It's important to note that we don't have a prescriptive method for what works. This is what we have found to be more effective or less effective. So Dutro and Bean actually discussed how individual, institutional, and systematic consequences of racism are often upheld and unchallenged. So as educators, we want to practice the exact opposite. We want to actually challenge racial stereotypes. So we offer more of this in our manuscript and our table. So we share ways that are more likely or less likely to lead to students sharing their testimony. So again, we don't have this formula for eliciting testimony, but we do offer practices that we found to be more effective based on our research. Paris and Aleem actually discuss this ever-changing, evolving way of looking at culture and race. So instead of assuming what students relate to, it's important to learn from students. So we learn by questioning and by building relationships where questioning is just a part of the routine. So we want to prepare teachers to center student experiences and continuously challenge racial stereotypes. So providing a space where students can actually name and discuss their experiences, which often include racial stereotypes, is key. So providing that space. We often get questions about how this would look, as many of the teachers that we've talked to are fearful or like just sometimes apprehensive about bringing up the topic of race in their classrooms. So we often respond by encouraging educators to ask questions. Asking questions and providing a space where students feel safe enough to answer and even ask questions of their own is a valuable part of this. So for me in elementary as an educator, this looks like including time and space for conversations that elicit critical witnessing and testimony, and actually protecting that time for this to occur. So an example is something that we have daily. It's a 20-minute block of time that's protected, and it's a morning meeting. So we have discussions that are teacher-led and even sometimes student-led. Another example is including agency and journaling, where students can write and respond with the expectation that their teacher is going to read their journal entry and even sometimes respond. So really just prioritizing the relationship building among students and teachers. And sometimes even if that means prioritizing that over content.
And we realize that that can be a sometimes dangerous recommendation in this educational climate.
I think that's one that our pre-service teachers would very much appreciate from what I've heard from them, is those reminders to that it's okay to pause and it's okay to focus and be responsive. And I think you've just given us like an incredible list of scholars to check into, but also are there like very concrete ideas that we could bring into our classrooms to help with that, ability to be responsive in the moment, which I know can be incredibly challenging, but you know, I completely agree is incredibly important as well. So thank you so much. I have one last question for you all. I appreciated that this manuscript was not, and you mentioned this in the piece, that it's not a static example of effective or ineffective pedagogy. And I think because published research is so polished and is such a polished version of the research process and narrative, I think graduate students, we tend to build out impressions that this work is easier and a little more linear than it truly is. Do you all have any advice for grad students as we come into projects that don't have clear results and maybe don't always have positive sort of resolutions?
Sure. So that for me, as a student, that was actually hard to accept. I was looking for a formula or protocol that I could follow that would give me a concrete answer. I work in elementary where we often have interventions that are, if you do this, this is the result. So I honestly found it difficult to complete research without this rigid answer. However, as I continued reading through our transcripts, we worked a lot, Dr. Panther and I, reading through our transcripts, coding, and then discussing our findings. And I just realized how rich the data are. And it's actually quite complex and includes a variety of ideas. So I have realized that when conducting research, researchers will discover various avenues. From this one summer 2020 study, we have been able to discuss, write, and present numerous findings. So I no longer think of research as just having one clear result. I now go into it with this question of what will we discover? So that would be something that I would recommend going into research for other students or researchers. It's just being open to discoveries and what other doors might be open through your research, keeping that question in mind of what will I discover?
I really love that. That's really fantastic. Just keeping that question, what will we discover, front of mind. That's incredibly helpful. Those are all my questions. And I just wanted to say how much I appreciate both of you for taking the time to speak with us and to share about your work with Jolly's readers. To our listeners, this manuscript will be available in Jolly's Spring 2022 issue, which will be published in early May. So please check it out when it is published online. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.